Again, this is Bob Brundage, and today I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The date is November 14th, 1996, and today I'm at the home of Pancho and Marie Beard, certainly one of the most respected old-timers around. It's been associated with square dancing for many, many years, and we're interested in finding out a little bit more about Pancho's previous life before square dancing. So, Pancho, where were you born and brought up? And let's hear about it.
I was born in Colton, Oklahoma, in 1919, April 6th. And when I was 14, I moved to Dallas, Texas. My mother died when I was 3 years old, so I never, and my father did his best, but my sister, elder sister, wanted me to come down to Dallas, so I went down to move to Dallas, and she got me through high school.
Okay. And when were you starting to learn to play guitar and stuff?
Well, I started that in Oklahoma. There's an old fiddler lived down close to, not too far from where we lived, and he had a guitar, and I'd go down there, and he showed me the chords, and he'd play, and then he'd nod his head when I spoke to change chords. Generally, it was a two-chord tune.
All right.
So that's the way I really got started.
Huh, that's interesting. So your family was not musically inclined? Your family?
No.
Oh, that's interesting. So where'd we go from here? You moved to Dallas.
Well, I joined the Navy. When I got out of high school, I had a friend in Dallas who was manufacturing aircraft radios.
Huh.
In those days, you couldn't just go buy one. You had to have somebody make one. Even the airlines made their own equipment. And he asked me one day, he was chief engineer for WFAA in Dallas, and he taught me the code, and I'd go down there when he was on duty, and we'd sit around and talk, and he asked me one day, would you like to go up in an airplane? And I said, yeah. So we went out to Love Field, and the pilot who owned the plane, he was a salesman for the radios. We took off and went up, and he started talking. He was testing one of his radios. This Clyde Mosteller was his name. And I asked him, I said, who are you talking to? He said, I'm talking to Waco. And I said, no, I mean, who are the people on the ground you're talking to? Oh, he said, they're federal employees, they're civil aeronautics authorities, and he said they are called communicators. Would you like to? I said, that sounds like a pretty good job, aviation and radio, you know.
Right.
He said, well, when we get down, I'll take you over there. So he took me over there, and I met them, and every one of them was ex-Navy radioman. And it required 2 years' experience on a seagoing vessel, open to public correspondence, and be able to send and receive 35 words a minute. So I said, I think that's what I want to do. So when I got out of high school, I joined the Navy, and I went to San Diego, and I got assigned to, I went through the schools there, and they teach you the basic qualifications for a radioman, signalman, and quartermaster. Quartermaster is assistant to the navigator, and signalman, of course, is the semaphore.
Right.
And they made me a quartermaster. After I got out of school, it was 3 months long. And there I already had 6 months in, and still I had to get my 2.5 years in, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I told a communications officer, I said, I'd like to get what my problem was. And he said, well, you just don't have any vacancies. But One day I saw on the bulletin board where they wanted 50 seamen for duty in the Asiatic fleet, which is in China. And so I volunteered, and the officer, he said, "You're too young to go out there." I was 17. He said, "We don't send people out there that had him 4 years and hits in the Navy." So I was astounded one day when I heard over the PA system, "Hear this, the following named men lay up on the quarterdeck bagging baggies," and it had Baird, MR. And meanwhile, the Sino-Japanese War had started.
Uh-huh.
And so they were beefing up their personnel. They increased the personnel in the Asiatic fleet that way. And I went up on the quarterdeck, and they said, "Get your baggage and get up here." I said, "Well, what's the matter?" And they said, "Well, you're going to go to China." And I said, "I don't want to go to China. There's a war going on out there." They said, "Well, you're going." And so it took us 32 days to get, we went to I may be stringing this out too long for you.
No, that's okay. Very interesting.
We went to Hawaii, and we went to Midway, and we went to Wake Island, and we went to Guam, and we went to Manila. And from there, we went up to Shanghai, and the fleet was up north, and it stayed in North China in the summer and in the Philippines in the winter. And then we went up to Chifu, little town Chifu, and we got in there at night. And, of course, the ship I was to be assigned to sent a boat over, the USS Alden. It was a World War I destroyer. They call them four pipers. They had four stacks.
Right.
If you see, I know this can't, you can't see that. You see that little ship right up there,
right,
like that.
Model up on the
they sent
truck.
A boat over, and when I went aboard ship, the communications officer was standing there, and he says, "What do you want to be?" And I said, "Well, I want to be a radioman." He says, "You're a radioman." So I learned to qualify as a Navy radioman, and I spent my 2.5 years out there, and that was I could talk all day about what happened out there,
won't
do that. It was wartime. The Japanese and Chinese were at war, and we often wondered what we were doing out there anyhow. But anyhow, I served my time and eventually returned back to the States and got into the Civil Aeronautics,
uh-huh.
and later became Federal Aviation Administration.
Right. You probably didn't bring your guitar to China.
I had a guitar. You mean over there?
Yeah, right.
I had one, and I don't remember. I went back there during the war, incidentally. I went back over to... okay, I was on the invasion of Okinawa. I was in the Navy, but I was attached to the 6th Marine Division. And on the way back, we were there 64 days, and they announced on the PA system that somebody would like, we had two or three of us down playing our guitars and things, and that there was going to be a concert on the forecastle. They had a piano there, and had to be on this ship on Claude, was Claude Thornhill, a very famous band leader.
Right.
And I'd never heard of him.
Uh-huh.
But I got to meet him on that return visit, and that was before we went back and the war ended when I was in the Philippine Islands.
Right.
And that was in August, and I didn't get back to the States till the 24th of December that same year. But due to some unfortunate happenings, which I won't relate here.
Well, okay, so the war is over, and where'd you come back to Dallas?
No, I went back to Albuquerque.
Oh, did you?
I had switched to, one day I was chief aircraft communicator stationed out at El Morro, New Mexico. You may know where the National Monument is out
right.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had a station there, and since they got so short of men that they had to send women. My wife was a communicator.
All right.
And they didn't send them to the isolated stations, but I was chief communicator out there, and I had signed up when the war started, but I heard that if you join, they won't guarantee you your job, but if you get drafted, they have to give you your job.
I see.
So then I said, well, I'm not going to spend all that time in China and then not be able to get the job. So I got drafted. I think I was the only chief that got drafted out of the Civil Aeronautics. My draft board was in Ephrata, Washington. See, I was sent up there for my probationary period.
Yeah.
And so I went back in, and this time they sent us up to Camp Pendleton, and I was, as I say, attached to the Marine Corps.
Okay. Now, tell us about when you met Marie and how that came about.
Excuse me. Well, she was a communicator in Albuquerque.
All right.
And I had a girlfriend there. And when I got out of the Navy after the war, I went out there and I had my uniform on. And I asked for this girl that I had known. And I don't know whether she'd moved or been transferred or what, but one of the other communicators told her who I was, and we had a sort of a group party for the station one night, and I brought my guitar, and Marie came, and we were all singing, and first thing you know, I noticed what a beautiful voice she had,
right.
And
sure,
so yeah. I started dating her, and people would ask us, as they did later, to entertain a little bit. And so after, I don't know if she remembers all this better than I do, but wasn't long till we got married.
Okay, and of course she plays the piano too.
Yes,
so
yes.
You became a team, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, all right, then, well, when I visited you way, way back many, many years ago, you took me out to one of the stations that was a homing device, and you said you had, that was one of your parts of your job at the time, was to track. Do you remember where that was? And so on? I don't remember.
What year was it?
Oh, golly. Don't ask.
Well, I was stationed in Albuquerque, and then after they got more help, I was stationed at Acomita, which is out on the Acoma Reservation, and then I got transferred to up here to Santa Fe, and from here they kept adding different facilities to my workload. I ended up with about 10 technicians and had this whole part of northern New Mexico. Now,
yeah.
I changed my rating. When I was at El Morro one day, a DC-3 landed. We had a little emergency field there. And pretty soon here came a small jet plane.
Uh-huh.
And the DC-3... was carrying fuel for this little jet.
Oh, damn.
And I talked to the pilot, and I said, my gosh, I said, do you have to have that thing to carry the fuel? And he said, well, he said, we have to fly at low altitude. And he said, they just eat fuel at low altitude. He said, if I could get up 25,000 feet, he said, I'd have a very, very good... fuel efficiency. And I said, well, now, you wouldn't be interested in the weather. No, he wouldn't be interested in the weather. Well, we made weather observations and broadcast them. Uh-huh. I said to myself, I'm obsolete. In a few years, planes are going to be flying 25, 30,000 feet, and they don't care what's happening at El Morro, Acomita, or any of these places.
Right.
So I had a FCC license in radio telegraphy. So I changed my job from communicator to principal radio electrician, and I maintain the air navigation aids.
Right. Okay. So many years ago when I visited you here, you were running dances out in your little dance hall out here in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the few people that I knew that owned their own dance hall right on their own property. And so tell us a little bit about that. I know you've had many, many well-known callers here.
Yeah, I have signatures on the wall over there. Quite a number. I can't call them all, but...
I remember Bruce Johnson. I just interviewed him last week, so...
Yeah, Bruce and Ed Gilmore and Joe Lewis and... I'd have to go over and
look. Sure, right.
But I rented this hall, incidentally, about a year ago to a fellow who was teaching karate. And he painted everything, and I told him, I said, these signatures are friends of mine in the square dance field, and I didn't know what to do with it, whether to cut that piece out of the wall or what, you know, and I said, well, go ahead and paint over it.
Okay.
Well, I went over there, and he painted the whole thing, and he left this big blob there.
Yeah.
He says, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Okay. He said, I just couldn't do it, so they're still over there.
Well, you used to run weekly dances here, didn't you?
Yeah, well, it was every other week.
Every other
week, yeah. I just some friends. It was strictly volunteer. What whatever they could want to put in the pot, I didn't charge them anything.
Right.
I just paid my gas and lights and taxes, and I did that for, oh gosh, I don't know, 15 years or so.
Yeah. I remember when I was here, I called a contra dance for you. Do you remember
mm-hmm.
that?
Yes, I do.
Because a lot of people out this way are not that familiar with contras. And we had a great time, I remember. But anyway, okay, one of the crowning achievements of your experience has been a record called Smoke on the Water.
Yes.
Now, if I... can be so presumptuous. I have always said that this was the initiation of well-known callers nationally, because I think this particular record, it really took off, and it was one of the first ones that had a major sale nationwide. I know at the time it came out for months and months, so I had to call that particular number at every dance that I call. So tell us a little bit about Smoke on the Water.
Let's see. I had called. I see, we played at the dance in Oklahoma City. I don't recall whether it was a national or just a state dance, but we played it, and I met doctor came out here and built some square dance facilities over here at Milwaukee, and he hired a lot of the national callers, and he hired Paul Phillips. And that's how I met Paul and Margaret. And when we were in Oklahoma City, we were sitting there talking, and I had written a couple of songs. I wrote a dance to a lady of Spain. And I've used some stop breaks in it, and I changed key, and I fancied it all up. Right. At least that's what I considered it.
That's on the flip side of Smoke on the Water, right?
And Paul had a little disc cutter, you know, a little, and he said, "I'd like for you to put those two on for me." So I did smoke on the water and Lady of Spain, and unbeknownst to me, he sent it to Mike Michelle,
right,
out at Western Jubilee.
Right.
And Mike called me and he said, "What happened?" That Paul had sent him that record, and he said, "I'd like to record you." And I said, "Well, I have equipment here to do the recording." And he said, "I'll pay you $100 a side." And well, I said, "Okay." And so I got my band together, and I only had one microphone. And I had the fiddler in the kitchen, and I had Marie played the piano, and I played the guitar, and we recorded those two numbers and sent it in to Mike Michelle. Well, he paid me $400, and I forgot about it. And at that time, we were going up to Pine Point, up at Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin,
right,
you know. And when we got up there, well, I saw Al, your brother, and Al said, "Poncho," said, "that record of yours is really going over back east."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, I'm glad to hear that, Al, because I hadn't heard anything." And then Ed told me, "Well, your dance is really going over in Southern California." And Manning said, "It's going over in Texas." And of course, I thought it was the Lady of Spain, you know. And so somebody said, "Well, no," he said, "you made two records, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "But Lady of Spain was my favorite." "Oh, no, we're not talking. We're talking about Smoke on the Water." So when I got back home, Mike called me and signed me up, and I made a few more for him.
Oh, good. Did you ever record any other labels?
Yes, I recorded for Marvin Schilling.
Oh, yeah.
It was a Lightning S,
right,
label, and I recorded for Pappy Shaw's.
Oh, yeah, the Lloyd Shaw label.
Yeah, I put out one yeah, for them.
Okay.
And Marvin, did I say Marvin Schilling?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, in the strict sense of the word, you are not a traditional or the type of caller that's out teaching classes every night in the week and then calling for square dance clubs, per se. You were more of an entertainer and a musician that backed up these other fellows. How about national conventions? A little while ago, you mentioned Denver, I think.
Well, we were featured at the national convention in Dallas. Marie,
yeah,
and I were on TV there. I think we did Cool Water on just one number, we received a little certificate of achievement from that, and generally the people wanted us to sing.
Yeah.
And nearly every place we go, well, I'd like to mention that the fellow that helped me tremendously in my calling was a fellow named Pat Patterson, who lived here, and he took me under his wing, and there were, at that time, there were 12 clubs here.
Good.
And he came down one night to the dance, and we had club members who were calling. He put on a record, and he looked around and he said, "I want you and you and you to stand up and introduce yourself and your wife." Well, what he had done, he put that record on and he looked to see who was patting their foot to the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of them. And there were two other fellows. And he said, would any of you like to learn to call? And I said, "I sure would." I had a cousin in Oklahoma who used to, during cotton picking time, they'd take all the wagons down to the gin, and they couldn't gin them fast enough, so they'd call it the wagon yard. He'd put up a little platform about 12 feet square, and he'd call square dances, and you could hear him for a half mile. You know, he'd say, and colorful patter like the old wildcat squall and the panther ball on the ground flew up and the bushes bent before long hours we had them spent and come along, cowboy, have a little fun. We hope daylight will never come. Meanwhile, they're doing the do-si-do.
Sure, right.
Well, I'll always remember him. His name was Toe Bussey. He was my cousin. And so Pat told me, he said, okay, I'll teach you to call. But he says, I don't want you to use any patter. Well, that just broke my heart. He said, I'll give you the dance. And he says, I want you to call the commands so that you're not too ahead or far ahead of them or too far behind them. And every time I called, he never danced. And he had a group of kids called the Fireflies that danced in the dark, high school kids. And they were in demand. We went over, and Marie and I would go along as chaperones for the kids. And we went over to Childress, Texas, and Amarillo, and up into Oklahoma. And Pat would manage to get me on the program, but I still couldn't use any patter. And finally, he told me one day, he said, okay, he said, this is about a year almost. Okay, he says, I think you can use patter now. So
okay.
That was one of the highlights of my career when Pat did that. And Pat was a wonderful caller. I don't know if you knew him or not.
I knew of him more than, I may have met him here, as a matter of fact, when I was here years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, you mentioned a lot of the other callers that you've worked with, and many that have been here to your own little dance hall. Did you know Lee Helsel?
Who?
Lee Helsel.
Yes, I knew Lee Helsel. See, this doctor that came out here from Dallas and built this square dance thing, he hired Lee Helsel and Bob Osgood and Paul Phillips and Joe Lewis and all the big names then, and we played for him. My band played for him.
Right.
Ray Smith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. One of the things in our conversation before we started tape recording, you said that you wrote a song at one time. In fact, you wrote more than one.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I've written quite a few songs. I don't know, some of them good, some of them bad, I suppose. This particular one was that they recorded in Nashville was called Hello Zoo. It says, I met you last night, and if I remember right, it seems to me we had a drink or two. You gave me your phone. I said I would phone or something. But anyhow, I said, when I call that number, they said, hello, this is a zoo. That's the theme behind the thing.
That's the theme, okay.
And so she gave him this fake number, and then he met her again, and he gave her his number, and she called him, and he says, hello, this is the zoo, a big tiger talking just for you. and I said, now we're as happy as we can be, and I'll forget. I can't remember.
Oh, that's good. That's great. So, Oh, you mentioned that you did quite a bit of recording for local people on what you call a Zia label, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got some of these records left.
Oh.
And
they're terrible.
Well, that's all right. I wish I had a copy of my brother's first recording on a 5-star label way back years ago. I had one when it was the old shellac, and I left it in the attic, and it cracked.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was going to bring up that I wish we could have a couple of copies for the Lloyd Shaw Art Dance Archives, if that's a possibility. We can talk about that sometime in the future.
You mean the song or a square dance?
Either one. We're looking for what we can get.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, well, getting away from square dancing for a minute. I know you're a very avid golfer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you play golf around here quite a bit.
Yes.
We enjoyed a very nice lunch with you at the country club down the road. And I happen to enjoy golf, too. I'm not very good at it, but we got to get together and play sometime.
I'd enjoy that.
Right. Are there any other... you know, one thing I wanted to ask you. Suppose somebody called you up today and said, Pacho, will you play a dance for us? Would you do it?
I don't know. It depends on... See, the hardest part are the singing calls.
Yeah.
The hoedowns, no problem. But if I don't know the... and you have to know the song in three or four different keys.
Right.
And we worked harder on singing calls than anything else.
Sure.
Because I remember one time up at the Denver convention, Bob, pause it just a minute, please.
Go ahead.
Well, I was on a panel with Pappy's Bergen and
Fred Bergen, yeah,
and
Jack Barber.
Jack Barber, and I had told a caller, I said, we found that certain callers want certain keys, you know, and a lot of people didn't believe that. They said, for instance, Ed Gilmore, he thought that you should be able to call in any key. Well, he could. That's his style of calling.
Right.
But most callers couldn't. And so they asked Jack Barber, somebody asked Jack Barber, why he didn't put out more hoedowns in the key of A. Now, I know the key of A is probably the most used key in hoedowns.
Is that right?
A, but fiddlers like D. D is horrible
to
call in. So Jack Barber, hope that you don't publish this. You can delete it if you want to.
Okay.
They said, why don't you put out more hoedowns in A? And he says, what's the matter? Are you too lazy to learn to call in the key of D? So I said, are you too lazy to learn to play it in A? And the place went crazy.
Right.
But you could cut that out.
Okay. Oh, that's funny. I remember we were at a festival in New Hampshire one time. Ed Durlacher was there. And, of course, his band are all accomplished musicians in New York City and union musicians. And they were playing with our little band called the Pioneers. And so as he started to call, he turned to the band and said, drop it a half tone. Okay, well, these fellas don't, you know, you don't go from C to B flat just like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were playing in G, I think, and they played a G7 and dropped it all the way to C. And Durlacher never said a word, but be that as it may. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you just one thing else I'll add. I happen to have a fiddler that read music. And I told him, I said, I want you to just hold us together. I said, don't play anything fancy or anything.
Yeah.
Just hold us together. And he said, well, I think that there ought to be more confusion. I said, nobody's listening to you.
Yeah.
And Joe Lewis is calling out here. And I said, I want you tonight to play two hoedowns. That's all. We have a hoedown, singing call, and a hoedown. And Joe could call all night to take me back to Tulsa,
right.
Because that's the first thing he asked a fiddler to play. And so when it was over, we went out, and I asked my fiddler, I said, ask him. He said, did you notice what we played tonight? Oh, no, we're listening to the caller. And that convinced him. And from then on, I never had any problem with that at all. But he could play in different keys.
care.
And I could. And Marie, now Marie always had to find the chords for us.
Okay.
Because she can read music.
But yeah.
I learned to read a little bit, but not enough to do it. But I could generally turn my volume down or get away from it somewhere.
Right. Well, you must have been impressed by Joe Louis's accordion.
Well, he didn't have it. Well, I believe he had it here, but he didn't use it. He agreed with that I had a good band.
Good.
And I think he did too. His music was entirely different. And I really enjoyed him.
Well, he was a perfectionist too.
Yes.
Yeah. I know he. Really a great musician. That accordion that he had, of course, it sounded like a three-piece band because the bass mm-hmm. notes sounded like a bass fiddle and the chord notes sounded mm-hmm. like a guitar and the keyboard sounded like an accordion.
He had some electronics background and he wouldn't let me look at it. But he did tell me he had to keep it on dry ice or something, so I'm assuming he used some crystal elements of some sort,
right.
But I wasn't interested in what it was. But he got by with it. Did an excellent job.
Sure did. As a matter of fact, this is really the forerunner of our modern day keyboard, with mm-hmm. the sideband and the the syncopators and all this and that. Mm-hmm. And he'd done it himself in his own little workshop many many years before. So, well, I think we're just about down to the end of our session here, Pancho.
Okay.
It's been really interesting. Do you think we ought to get Marie to say a few words?
Well, she'd be happy to.
Well, very good. I'm going to put this on pause for a few minutes and see if we can't get Marie in here. Okay, so now we're talking to the other half of this combo, Marie Baird. Marie, you and Pancho have been together for a long, long time, and I know you've done an awful lot of entertaining. Just before we get into some of that, I understand that you sang with the Sweet Adelines for a while.
Yeah, I belong to the High Desert Chorus here.
There you go.
For over 8 years.
Is that so?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Muchísimo.
I
love to sing.
Yeah, I know you do. And you have a beautiful, beautiful voice.
Yeah, thank you.
Everybody that I've ever heard you sing will say the same thing. And so tell us about your association with Mr. Baird here.
Would you believe we've been married 50 years?
There you go.
Yeah.
Good.
We celebrated our 50th last Wednesday the 6th.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
That recently. That's great.
Well, I met him when he came back from the Navy after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for the then Civil Aeronautics Administration, mm-hmm. which is now the Federal Aviation Administration. And he came back from the Navy, and of course I had a boyfriend who was pretty jealous, and he was telling everybody that we were engaged. Everybody knew it but me. And, but a girlfriend called and asked me if I'd go out with Pancho, so I did. And we had a real good time. Danced and real good time. And then this fellow was saying around he was going to beat Pancho up, so he couldn't allow him to do that, so he asked me for another date.
Okay. Well, and of course you played piano, mm-hmm. but you had a musical background probably.
Well, not really. I mean, it's God-given. I took piano lessons for 3 months back when I was 10 or 12,
is that right?
And that's all the technical I've had. But I've sung all my life and played by ear all my life.
Oh, you played by ear.
Yeah, I was in the glee club in college, the women's glee club. I've had good directors and learned a lot, that way. And then I'm kind of self-taught other than that.
Well, you've pounded those keys many, many times.
Oh, have I ever.
Yeah.
And watch the dancing and the dresses and talk to my friend.
I know. It's really amazing. Because my mother was an accomplished pianist, but she was he was started as a classical pianist.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And as many times as she played Little Brown Jug, she still had to have that music in front of her.
Oh, she did.
Yeah. But be it as it may.
What did your father play?
No, my father, the only instrument he ever played was bass drum in the American Legion drum corps.
But you had a family band.
Well, it wasn't his mother and Al and I.
Oh, I see.
But Dad was always supportive, and he drove the car. But,
yeah.
That's about it. But,
yeah.
And a lot of people think that Al and I learned from our father, when actually it was the other way around, that the first year that Al and I were in college at the same time, he was a senior and I was a freshman, is when my father started to call.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so he called so that the band would stay together, so that when we were home for vacation in the summertime and so forth, we'd have the band to still be together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was many, many years ago. But
it was fun.
Oh, yeah, it was really great fun, of course. So.
Well, my family all sang, but not to the extent that I have.
Uh-huh.
And I thought everybody could sing until I started school and I found some of the kids couldn't sing.
Right. Yeah. I asked Pancho a little earlier. I said, if I called you up and asked if you'd play a dance tonight, I said, would you do it?
What'd he say?
He
said
kind
no.
Kind of avoided the issue. But,
I would. I could play any time.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we ought to get a band together. Any of the musicians that you've worked with here locally, are they still around?
I don't think so. One has died. One moved to, two have died. One moved to Missouri.
Yeah.
One moved to St. George, Utah.
Yeah.
The
people you worked with here, when you had your own little dance hall going, just you and Pancho and the fiddler, is that about it?
Well, no, usually just Pancho and I.
Oh, is that so? Okay.
We're playing.
Yeah. Well, I know you've played with many of the, or listened to many of the other bands, the Schroeder's Playboys. Did you ever play with them?
I don't think I ever played with them.
Yeah.
I played with Al's band up in Boston.
The King Street, the old Pioneers?
I don't remember their name,
yeah,
but
the
I played the piano with them.
Did
and
really?
Oh, it was great.
That was at the Boston Convention?
Uh-huh.
Oh,
the Atlantic Coast, first Atlantic Coast.
Oh, there's so many stories from that convention you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, I believe. I was there.
Yeah, well, I remember one story about the fellow that got up to call, and it was a singing call, and he missed the first couple of words, and he waited till the band played the whole verse and the chorus before he started. He kept saying, "Now you wait a minute, it's coming around here." But he didn't know how to say "Join hands, a circle left," just to get into it.
To get it, yeah.
But
I didn't hear that one.
So, well, golly, that was many years ago in Atlantic.
Yeah.
First forerunner of the Atlantic Convention,
mm-hmm.
and then it moved down to the Washington, D.C. area. Of course, did you know any of the present-day band, that the one with the Red Boot Boys? You ever know of that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, Shirley, it's been nice talking to you.
Yeah, enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it, I tell you. These stories, many of the stories that Pancho told before we started the tape recording.
We've had some great ones.
I'll bet. So, well, I want to thank you, Marie, for your hospitality, and thank you for taking the time to listen to me and get this stuff down on tape. And Pancho, thank you very much. So we'll look forward to seeing you again real soon.
Sure.
Maybe we can play foursome sometime on the golf course. Good. Thanks a lot. Marie was just telling me a funny story that happened to their band at one time. Go ahead, Marie.
Well, let's see. It started up at Marvin Schilling's Lightning S Ranch. A group of us were sitting out in the anteroom, out of the dining room, waiting for dinner. And Glenn Rigg, a caller from Los Alamos, and Selma Hovland, a caller from Wagon Mound, were over with me at the piano, and they ran me through the intro and first line of No, No, Nanette. And I got that, great, and then the dinner bell rang and we all dashed into the dining hall to eat, and that was the end of it. And then later that spring, we were hired to play this dance in Morenci, Arizona. So we got all set up. There were four of us, I guess, the fiddle, guitar, piano, and bass. And Poncho asked the singing callers to come up and say what singing call they were going to do so we could check on keys and et cetera. And this man came up. I think he came when it was his time, and he said, "I'm going to do Luna Nanette." And Poncho said, "Why don't you do something else? We don't know that very well," which was a master of understatement. We didn't know it from anything. And he said, no, that's the one I sent in. I was going to call. That's the one I'm going to call." So we said, "No, okay." He said, "Just follow me." It's your famous last words anyway. So I started out, the intro was great, and he started, the first phrase was fine, and then we fell apart. We didn't know the tune, we didn't know where the key, what key change is, we couldn't hear each other, we couldn't hear him. It was awful, just awful, and we floundered through it and finally got through, and he turned around and glared at us and stalked off the stage. And the funny part was, a fellow came up off the floor and he said, "That caller was terrible. He wasn't with the music at all." And there was no way I could tell him he couldn't be with that music. That music was, oh, it was terrible.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Okay.